Let's start with a story.
Let us take you back to medieval England. It's the year 1215, and the ruler is King John.
This is from a British Library animated video. Imagine a pig snorting as King John races by on his horse.
Many people believe that King John was one of the worst kings in history. He imprisoned his former wife, he starved his opponents to death, he allegedly murdered his own nephew, and pulled the beards of the Irish chiefs.
Okay, so why are we talking about this bad king from 800 years ago? It has to do with an anniversary being celebrated this year of a document King John was forced to sign by his fed-up barons that, at least in some places, has helped to shape every century since it was written.
The most famous clause, which is still part of the law today, for the first time gave all free men the right to justice and a fair trial.
Of course, we're talking about the Magna Carta, inspiration for British democracy, the U.S. Constitution, and democracy in much of the rest of the world. Here's what Eleanor Roosevelt said about it when she announced another influential document in 1948.
This Universal Declaration of Human Rights may well become the international Magna Carta of all men everywhere.
And women. She meant men and women. Welcome to Whose Century Is It? I'm your host, Mary Kay Magstud. The ongoing theme of this podcast is ideas, trends, and twists shaping the 21st century. The twist here is, what happens when you take the Magna Carta and its idea that a ruler is not above the law to a country where the current ruler says, that's a dangerous Western concept, and ever more ordinary people say, it actually seems like a pretty good idea to them? I'm talking, of course, about China, where the Magna Carta made a three-city tour of the mainland in October before moving on to Hong Kong. I was in Beijing when the Magna Carta was there, so I went along to the British ambassador's residence. An embassy guard from the Chinese government stood outside and checked people's IDs. This is a normal procedure for all foreign embassies and diplomatic buildings in China. Chinese military guards checking IDs before people step onto essentially foreign territory outside Chinese jurisdiction. There is also something new these days in front of many embassies and diplomatic buildings, a barricade with spikes that jut out at a diagonal. It's really kind of scary looking. On the one in front of the British ambassador's residence, the spikes were covered with plastic tips, but it still makes you wonder, what does the Chinese government think it's guarding against? How will these help? Anyway, the Magna Carta was supposed to be displayed in public venues, at People's University in Beijing, at a museum in Shanghai, and then on to Guangzhou, so lots of people could see it. But final permissions from the central government never came through. It's unclear whether this was in any way connected to the fact that President Xi Jinping was about to pay a state visit to Britain and is on the record saying Western-style rule of law is inappropriate for China. The upshot is that instead of being displayed for 2 or 3 days in a public venue where thousands of people could have seen it, the Magna Carta was shown in the British ambassador's residence in Beijing for 3 hours, and only to people who had registered in advance. There were slightly longer viewings at the British consulate in Shanghai and the U.S. consulate in Guangzhou. So sure, that's better than nothing. The Chinese government did not block the Magna Carta from entering the country, nor did it stop Chinese visitors from seeing it. But the Chinese embassy guards did check IDs. There is a record of who went in. So it's not terribly surprising that several of the Chinese visitors I chatted with in the British ambassador's residence were happy to share their opinions about the Magna Carta, but not their names. I asked a 22-year-old political science student if he thought the idea in the Magna Carta, that everyone should be equally subject to the law, is appropriate for China.
Yeah, it's really very important. We must restrict the power of the government. And it's very important for China's future. Because sometimes our government will beyond their boundary and do something to restrict the people's freedom.
What he's saying here in Chinese is, so it does have a lot of meaning. I asked if he thought China will move more in the direction of rule of law in his lifetime.
I don't think so.
He said, I'm relatively pessimistic. And then there was this woman who's a little older and works in the National Library of China.
The meaning, sure, I'm really interested in the context, but also because of its ancient manuscript.
So we were talking to people who are helping the Magna Carta tour around the world, and they said that they think and hope that people around the world can look at the Magna Carta and maybe learn something from it.
Yeah, sure.
Do you think
especially
that's...
Especially in China.
You think especially in China? Maybe, mm-hmm.
What do you think people here can learn from it?
I don't know. But especially for me, I think there is a lot of work to do here, I think.
Mm-hmm. In terms of rule of law?
Yeah, sure.
In terms of the leadership also being under the law?
Yeah, I think so. Mm-hmm.
Other Chinese visitors here were more or less optimistic about China's prospects for equality under the law and more or less convinced about the relevance of the Magna Carta to China's rule of law. These were mostly young Chinese who have grown up with a government that has repeatedly told them that there are Chinese values and there are Western values, and what's appropriate for the West is not necessarily appropriate for China. The argument goes that China has its own tradition, Confucianism, and with it, respect for hierarchy and obedience to those above you in the hierarchy. And it is true, China does have that tradition. It's also true that the Communist Party, for most of its time in power, criticized Confucianism as counter-revolutionary old thinking that had weakened China. The Chinese in Taiwan quite successfully retained aspects of Confucianism while embracing a modern democracy. In mainland China, it was only as Chinese lost faith in communism and started looking for meaning and ethical grounding elsewhere that the party started to encourage a re-embracing of Confucianism over the past few years. That's included all kinds of efforts, some more successful than others. There was this sprawling, epic, not very good film on Confucius in 2010, played opposite Avatar in Chinese movie theaters and got left in the dust. There has also been the opening of Confucius centers around the world to promote Chinese culture. And at one point, the authorities put up a statue of Confucius near Tiananmen Square. It remained there for a while, and then it mysteriously disappeared. Turned out it was put into an inner courtyard of the adjoining National Museum. The buzz going around at the time was that some within the party thought it was disrespectful to Mao Zedong to put Confucius out there. Mao's portrait looks out onto Tiananmen Square, and his body is on display in a mausoleum within it. It has kind of an eerie orange glow, and people stand in long lines each morning to walk in and catch a glimpse. Worth doing if you're ever in Beijing. Anyway, back to Confucianism. Many of its core principles are admirable. A call for compassion and righteousness, a belief that people are basically good. But it's the part about obeying your superiors that most interests China's leaders. Even so, for all their insistence that there is this sharp divide between Chinese values and Western values, China has actually signed the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. It has signed and ratified the UN Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. And China's own constitution says that all citizens are equal under the law, that the state respects and preserves human rights, that Chinese citizens enjoy freedoms of speech, press, assembly, association, freedom of religion, and the right to demonstrate. It's just that the party always reserves the right to put its own interests first. And in that one sense, it's not so different from what King John believed was his right in England 800 years ago.
Because he believed that he was above the law. He believed he was the law. He was the source of the law.
This is Chris Pullen, the Chancellor of Hereford Cathedral in England. He came along to China with his cathedral's copy of the Magna Carta, one of 17 surviving copies from the 13th century.
John quickly overturned Magna Carta. King John, he didn't really want that. So it took a long time to establish. Magna Carta was reissued many times through the 13th century because kings kept on falling away from the standard which it set, and then they would need support or they would want to raise taxation or something, so they would reissue Magna Carta. So it was as if there was an understanding all along that something better, something more just, something more fair in terms of how the nation was run was recognised although it kept on being fallen away from, it would be revived again and again. The aspiration was never lost, the hope.
Do you think there's anything inherently Western about those values, about that aspiration? Because that's how it's perceived here, but I wonder whether it's you reach a certain level of development and you start aspiring for more respect, dignity, more of a voice.
Yes, I suppose the Western culture of individualism, which has in fact increased, hasn't it, over time, probably does well reflect the kind of aspirations in Magna Carta. And in that sense, perhaps it can be seen as a more Western kind of mindset that lies behind it. Although, interestingly, in the Middle Ages in England, I think there was a far less individualistic understanding of society, so that Magna Carta is perhaps one of the kind of seeds that has led to that tradition growing, actually. People look at Magna Carta and they say, what was the name of the scribe who copied it out? We don't know. He was a scribe, and he was content to be a scribe.
So, in fact, there wasn't a lot of individualism when the Magna Carta came into being, nor was there when Confucius came up with his philosophy 1,700 years earlier. If Confucius had lived in 1215, what philosophy might he have created then? What if he were living now, in today's China? It's an interesting question, how wise it is to take literally philosophies, religions, and texts created at a particular moment within specific historical circumstances, even though people knew far less then about certain things than we do now. Reasonable people can argue either side, and they have done. But it's fair to say that ideas and ways of life evolve, and at least some of what made sense in 500 BC or 1215 AD, when there were still slaves and feudalism and constant wars for territory, might need some rethinking today. Take the idea that women should obey their husbands. Seemed perfectly reasonable for centuries when women were considered to be something between property and dependence. Now that women around much of the world have gained rights, status, education, and independent assets, not so much. Sure, ISIS can say that women should still be considered property and should obey their husbands, but in the modern world, ISIS has become an exception. Still, it begs a question. Are there universal human rights of which governments like China's are in violation when they jail people who call for those rights to be respected? Or do such governments get a pass based on cultural differences?
Yeah, that's a question.
This is Mark Gill. He's the executive director of the Magna Carta Trust 800th Anniversary Committee. He, too, traveled in China with the Magna Carta.
Because China is on a journey, like all countries are, particularly about trying to define what rule of law means, how it can be made practical for people. And I think it's very clear that every country in the world is facing this challenge. In Britain, for example, much of the debate at the moment is around access to justice, which is one of the key principles that Magna Carta tried to lay down. So I get a real sense here that people are not necessarily wanting to copy Magna Carta, because you can't. A lot of it isn't relevant today. But there's a real interest in why it happened, what can we learn from it, what does it mean?
What does it mean when some 200 civil rights lawyers and other legal advocates were detained this year for operating as though the rights in China's constitution are genuine, inviolable rights? Let me give the floor to a Chinese civil rights lawyer who himself has been kidnapped and beaten up by Chinese public security officials three separate times. Teng Biao is now in exile in the United States. He says the way he was treated, the way his colleagues are still being treated, is what comes when leaders feel they are above the law, that they are the law.
The Communist Party's logic is if you criticize the government, if you criticize officials, if you say something to foreign media, you are against the government, and then you are against the party, and then you are subverting the state, the regime.
In their minds, the party and the state and the country are all the same thing.
Yeah. If you criticize the party, they label you as anti-Chinese people and anti-China.
And he says the Chinese people deserve better than that.
Yeah, this kind of consciousness of civil society is rising, even though the censorship is very severe and the party controls the traditional media. But gradually, people can access the information from outside world, and the Western theory of liberal democracy and rule of law, constitutionalism, became popular among scholars and students, especially thanks to the development of internet. So it's easier for the people to get the information and to connect other people. And then we have more and more government organizations, more and more human rights defenders. These people and organizations tend to be connected and organized. So even though the crackdown, the control never stops, in China, the civil society or the consciousness of the civil society is increasing.
So what does all this have to do with the question, whose century is it? The answer is clear to Tung Biao.
That's nonsense that the 21st century is China's century. I don't think so. You know, Xi Jinping's Chinese dream is very different from the American dream. Chinese dream in the context of Communist Party is a collective dream. It's a dream of a strong state, a strong government. So there's no personal freedom or human dignity, human rights in this Chinese dream. I don't care about nationalism. I don't care this century is American century or Europe century or Japanese century. I don't care. What I care is people's rights and freedom.
That's a sentiment that has echoed through the centuries. America certainly has its issues here too, from government overreach and spying on U.S. citizens to a law enforcement system that disproportionately targets African Americans, and on and on. Figuring out this rule of law thing is a work in progress for every country, but recognizing that it matters is a good start. Thanks for joining me for this episode of Whose Century Is It? For those of you who have been listening since the beginning, you'll notice that there's been a strong China theme running through most of the podcast so far. One reason is that I'm a former China correspondent. I lived there for 15 years. But another is that China's rise and the kind of power it becomes will almost certainly be a significant factor in shaping this century. As we go along in this podcast, I will expand out and visit other places and focus on other issues that have less to do with China, sometimes nothing at all. But in the next episode, I am staying with China because you kind of have to when you talk about climate change. And climate change will certainly shape this century, especially if we don't get the response right. Join me next time to hear some considered opinions from Beijing. And meanwhile, if you like the podcast, go to iTunes and subscribe. While you're there, give us 5 stars so other people can find it more easily. You can also listen on SoundCloud or Stitcher, or go to our webpage, pri.org/century, where there's more on the Magna Carta, and of course, links to previous episodes. Whose Century Is It? Is a co-production between me, Mary Kay Magstead, and PRI's The World, in partnership with the BBC and WGBH. It's funded by a grant from the Henry Luce Foundation. I'll be back in a couple of weeks with my take on whether China just might help save the planet after years of making climate change worse. Come on back and listen in.